The story of Ethernet is best told in personal stories shared by its very own creators, providers, and users. The Voices of Ethernet Archive is dedicated to preserving Ethernet's oral history, recording pivotal events that may have been forgotten or remain unknown, through a collection of spoken records with the individuals engaged in the technology's global emergence as the foundation of Internet.
Today we'll talk with Jeff Thompson, one of the people behind Ethernet Stories, to hear his account and experience with an important milestone in the technology's history. Thanks for joining, Jeff. Could you please introduce yourself?
Certainly, Peter. Thank you. My name is Jeff Thompson, as Peter said. I've been a contributing member of IEEE 802.3, the Ethernet Working Group, and it's the group that maintains and develops new variations of the .3 standard. I've been doing this since March of 1983. Among many other duties, I was chair of the working group from 1993 until 2002. During that period, we developed and approved standards for 100 base T and gigabit Ethernet, including 1000 base T. Those standards effectively cemented Ethernet as the top dog in wired LANs.
And created the base T ecosystem we know today.
Yes, indeed. And we'll talk a little more about that later.
Cool. So what was the driver to get involved in Ethernet, right? So where did you start?
Well, I was a very, very early customer of Ethernet. I worked at Xerox Research. I was working on laser printing, and David Boggs, the co-inventor of Ethernet, provided my colleagues and I with a couple of the first Ethernet boards. The multiple computers that we had in our labs could trade files back and forth. That was sometime in 1974. So I was an early user of the experimental Ethernet at Xerox. I switched from research over to development in 1981. And early in 1983, I was doing hardware logic design for a Xerox workstation. And one of my tasks was to do the Ethernet interface board. At that point, Xerox, along with Intel and DEC, had released the open spec for Ethernet. They did that in the fall of 1980. And this was 1983, so .3 had not yet fully approved their version of what was more or less the same spec. So my motivation in going to .3 was to try to make sure that my design would be fully interoperable with hardware which conformed to either flavor of the spec.
So if you go back, just as a clarification, I've read some of the story. There was a name for that laser printer I don't remember. But I think it was effectively the first, it was the granddaddy of all laser printers. Is that correct to say?
Yes. The first laser printer was called EARS, which stood for Ethernet Alto Raster Slot. Slot was scanning laser output terminal.
That's the name I remember hearing of, or it was Slot.
My boss built a page-a-second laser printer that sat on the early Ethernet network at Park and serviced the entire community. Yes, I worked for Gary Starkweather, who was the inventor of the laser xerographic printer.
So that's two different key technologies you were sitting at the boundary of.
Yes, and there was a third, which was the Alto personal computer. So the triad that Park came up with in the mid-70s, which was, quote, the office of the future, unquote,
So if I recall correctly with the Alto, it was the bitmap display and a mouse and everything else. And it was revolutionary in terms of a computer on every desk.
A computer on every desk and a keyboard under every employee's set of fingers.
And if I think through that, then Ethernet was the glue that sort of connected those different innovations together.
Well, that's certainly one theory, and it's certainly my theory.
If you thought about it, right, what's your part of the Ethernet story, right? Like when you came in, what was happening?
Well, they were trying to put together a task force to do a spec for the repeater for 802.3. That piece had not been done adequately in the earlier Ethernet spec. So I got involved with that along with Ron Crane, Pat Thaler, a fellow by the name of Aidan Paul from BICC in England, a fellow from HP who's disappeared, and a couple of other folks.
So what was not done adequately, right? My belief is that the goal of standards is to make sure that stuff, minimum move requirements to make sure vendor A to vendor B to vendor C work together.
Yep. There wasn't enough there to do that. It was just that simple. It was an outline sketch for what they wanted the repeater to be, but it was not a complete spec. So we changed it from a two-port device, or they called it two half repeaters connected by a fiber optic link. We got rid of that concept and did what was basically a major win later, the multi-port repeater. So we specified it in a way that you had any number of ports on. And that proved to be very valuable later on.
And in today's terms, someone would call that thing a hub.
And in fact, a hub was the commercial term for repeater. So the standards term are repeater and bridge, and the commercial terms were hub and switch.
I might differ on that one a little because I used to sell bridges, and we started calling them switches when it went into hardware. So we tended to call them bridges when they were software and switch when it became hardware.
Not worth you and I arguing about that. Certainly not on this tape.
So that was the first part, right? What came in next?
Well, 10 base T. And the major accomplishment there was getting away from coax, which you ran down a hallway, to using phone wiring, which all had individual legs and centralized in a phone closet. Now, this was very important because right about at that point in time, up until that point, all phone wiring was literally owned by the phone company. They paid for it, they put it in. But when deregulation came along, they just walked away from it and turned ownership of it over to the building owner. So there was a whole lot of wiring there that was available for other use. By the way, AT&T overbuilt the amount of wiring in a building enormously. There's financial reasons for that I won't go into.
So that was also the time that Ethernet was competing with Token Ring. And Token Ring was more of a hub-based system.
Token Ring cabling was hub-oriented.
Yeah.
The topology of the network itself was actually a ring rather than a star. So it ended up being called what we named a puckered ring. So
I read something recently talking about some of these technologies, and they made the point that one of Token Ring's selling advantages was the ability to have the central point to look at this, and it was easier to add and remove. And going to 10 base T, apart from being able to use the 18G cabling added that ability into Ethernet?
Well, the coaxial-based Ethernet, the bus-based Ethernet, ran into problems in the real world. And that was that if anybody disconnected, it took down the whole net. And that people didn't like that very much. So 10 base T gave every station its own leg into a centralized hub. And you could maintain the network from that hub. That was the big advantage. Plus, the huge advantage that we got was it was free. It didn't take special wiring. The wiring was already there.
The cabling was already there.
And it gave us a tremendous leg up.
So sort of relating into that topic, part of what's in the hub part was the ability to actually be able to really usefully manage that system, right, effectively. And I know that management has been a key part of what you've been interested in. So you want to talk about what actually prompted the physical aid developers to have to tackle this?
Well, that was the great theory that a hub would let you manage the network. And I was involved in starting the project to do the definitions for that. And we took a couple of stabs at it, trying to get the project approved at .3, and they went nowhere. And we really had to boil it down to its least essence in order to get the project approved. And what that turned out to be was, if you had a hub, you could turn individual legs on and off. And that was what we were going to do in the project. Now, we did a lot.
That's not a lot.
It stunned us with its simplicity, but that's what it took to get the project sold. And of course, we put a lot more in. We put enough in so that you could actually tell what was going on. But
why do you think there was that opposition? Was it just a question of different people seeing different needs?
Yes, and different sensitivities to what it took to have an interoperable network. One of the things that was true was at that point in time, everybody thought Ethernet was a passing fancy and we would all move on to FTDI when we needed more speed. So there was a huge standards development effort for FTDI. What ended up...
For those who don't remember, that's the fiber distributed data interface. Is that the right name? Yes,
that's the correct name, although it had a twisted pair flavor as well. So everybody was expecting FTDI-based systems.
One more question.
To come in.
FTDI was also ring-based, wasn't it?
Yes. It was a token ring, but there were some technical differences that fixed some of the problems with the 802.5 IBM token. So it was better than .5. It was faster than .3 or .5. But its major flaw was it needed management. And you couldn't even start the ring without the whole management system being in place. And they got all the hardware done, but they never really got station management software done enough for the market to pick up on. So you don't need any management to make Ethernet work. You just plug it in and it works. And in the original Ethernet on coax, you of course didn't even have to power up a hub. You could just grab onto a piece of coax and you were a member of the network.
So just sort of digging into that one. So where did the 48-bit MAC address stuff come from? Because that's an important part that I'm not sure. The idea of every piece of hardware having its own address, I'm not sure that existed before.
when Xerox did the experimental Ethernet at Park, it only had 8-bit addresses. And it turned out that address management, and they were put in with a daisy chain jumper cable on the back. So it just turned out that managing those addresses and making sure that you only had one of every kind and you kept track of where they were on which side of what was called a gateway then, which was really a router, turned out to be a major nuisance. And so the first thought was for 32, and then they just decided you put them in when you manufacture and you use 48 bits, you eliminate the problem.
And 48 was bigger than 32 and yes, more than anyone ever thought we'd ever need.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
If you had your time back, would you have made them 64 bits?
Probably. But it's not clear that they have to be globally unique anymore either. So you can go either way on that one.
So if you were to start thinking about it, like, what do you think are the key elements that made Ethernet the success it's become?
First of all, was timing within the market was essential. It came at the right time in history. Bob Metcalfe was essential to the success. He went around the industry selling it and promoting it in a very, very effective manner through several phases of its development. And the fact that he was doing that, I think, had a lot to do with how successful it was. He did that both in public and going around to individual companies at the appropriate time.
So I did just recently read, there's a history of 3Com that someone wrote, which I recently read, and that covers that in a fair bit of detail.
There was a lot of luck involved. I think one of the things that made it successful was it was truly a peer network. Token Ring is an almost peer network because there's the source of the beaconing, which makes that station different from every other. If you lose that, you have to go through a whole arbitration mechanism to get it started again. Ethernet was truly a peer network when it was CSMACD. Also, in the initial years, and this was very important, it was exceedingly robust because the network had no memory at all. Every time you put a packet onto the network, it was a completely new network event and didn't depend on anything that happened before. So that meant it really was self-starting in the face of any kind of error.
So Ethernet in and of itself was stateless.
Yes, very much so. And the flexibility that .3 had with respect to media and that the original architecture had for that flexibility. The AUI connector on, quote, the computer before it went off to the network gave you a media independent interface. And if all you had to do—
Otherwise known as the MII.
Well, not until later, but yes. Called the AUI at the time.
Yeah, we.
But it gave us the flexibility to follow the demands of the market without fundamentally changing it. That was very important.
So Ethernet had the smallest amount of core principles it could, and everything else was follow the market.
Yep. And it had an organization in .3 that was well suited to doing that. Token Ring, not so much, because it was basically under the thumb of IBM, whereas .3 was not under anybody's thumb.
mean, someone's expressed it to me, the goal, they started off with the principle from day one that the goal was to open and have everyone come in and not be in control. You know, the Dix companies were willing to not be in control of the technology.
Yep. They were seeking a truly open standard. And Xerox recognized early on that they could do something which they could build a network that went around inside copiers. And that would be useful to them for saving harness money on copiers. Or they could go out and actually try to nurture a broad industry standard that let everybody interoperate. And that's really, that was the task that Metcalf took on. And he left Xerox to do it because he had more freedom to do it that way.
Just sort of thinking back through some of what you said, in terms of the timing, it was also after, but, you know, towards, as in when the whole DARPA and ARPA network was coming through, which was really rethinking what had been compared to what traditional vendors were selling. And the way the ARPANET developed was very different to what, you know, IBM or Burroughs or Sperry would have had you done.
Right, but it was relatively limited in its scope. It was really built as an academic network, and its goal really, when it started, was just to do remote login between universities. So there wasn't anything in the original ARPANET vision of how to have local area networks. It was a network for connecting different facilities together.
So Ethernet really let people extend the ARPANET vision?
Yes, it took it from being something that had an appearance at your facility to something that could spread throughout your facility.
So you mentioned that you were chair of DOT3 for a while. And are there any particular takeaways that you learned while you're doing that task?
Sure. One that will surprise you. And that was keep my mouth shut during discussions and take the opportunity as chair to be the last to speak. As you well know, I tend to be an opinionated loudmouth, just like yourself. And that was
I'm shocked.
So that was a challenging lesson for me to learn. But
that's the case of you have to figure out what role you're playing and play that as well as possible. And not all roles have the same role, you know, not all positions have the same roles and responsibilities.
Right. And it was easier to move an idea forward with the group if the idea had come from the floor than if it was my idea. So it really was learning to work with a consensus operation. And I think that was important for me, and I think it was also very important for DOT3.
Also building culture, right? Doesn't happen overnight, right? And it's hard to build. So if you have a little bit of a consensus and then you fall away again, it's actually harder to come back. So I think it has to be enriched over generations of leadership.
Yep.
All right, so quick short one. How did Ethernet change the world?
That's easy. Before LANs in general and Ethernet in particular, data communication was based on circuit switched channels that were built around the voice requirements of the telephone network. Basically, they were 4 kilohertz analog channels or the digital equivalent of that. And that orientation was maintained by the monopolies that were enjoyed by the phone companies or in other countries by the telephone bureaus that were often parts of the post office. Ethernet was much higher speed. It was based on packet switching rather than circuit switching. So those two things were a couple of the several major factors that broke the dominance of the phone companies and made provision for there to be another method of communication in the world. So it was very significant.
Okay, so I know you're still active and of a man of strong opinions. So what are the areas of Ethernet development that you're most interested in today?
We've gone from being a pioneering standard to being a very mature standard. And so now we're filling in little market niches that...
I checked the other day, in 2018, we're up to 5,600 pages.
Yes. Not all of them successful, but...
Not all of them successful.
But we've seen people come in to .3 with specialized requirements that are different enough that they can't or haven't been serviced by what we already have in our standard. And so we're doing some fill-in. And so that's interesting.
What do you think of our idea of doing this oral history and getting people's stories down?
Well, I love history, so I think it's a good thing. And I'm always in favor of the truth as opposed to anything else. Anything that Metcalfe tells you about history, he will label not as the history, but a history. And he talks about approximate truth. So I believe he's pretty correct in that. I've learned by being present while history was being made that what gets written in a book is not quite the way you remember it, but it's not wrong, and very often it's good enough. So,
and from some points of view, history tends to be like a photograph of a real scene, and it gets some key parts and it misses some others.
Yep.
And where you take that photograph from, your point of view, that matters a lot.
And who has the camera?
And who has the camera? I think Bob said to us that it depends which meeting you're at, right? Which session, which bar, it's your story is somewhat different. So we appreciate hearing stories today from Jeff Thompson. Thank you for joining.
You're very welcome.
Tune in to hear other voices of Ethernet as we continue to document the evolution of Ethernet since 1973 and explore where the technology's story might go next. Thanks for joining.